to Yerachmiel Binyamin Ben Zalman Svi, Rabbi Jerry Witkin. Elaine Steinmetz has yard site for her father, and we hope that he has an Aliyas Hanashama from the Divrei Torah that we will learn today. So when it comes to Purim, we know at the very end of Megillas Esther, in the ninth chapter of the Megillah, we are told, Kayamim asher nachu bahem hayuhudim me'oyvehem, when finally the Jews were given reprieve from their enemy, va'achodesh asher nepach lehem miyagol nesimcha, and the month that was supposed to be the month of devastation, the month of destruction, finally turned around to become a month of wonderful things, and me'eva liyamtov lasos osam yimei mishteh v'simcha, u'mishloach manos ish l're'ehu, u'matanos le'evyonim. So the pasuk outlines for us that in commemoration of this amazing miracle, Mordechai and Esther instituted that we were now going to have an annual day of commemoration. And how are we supposed to spend that day? The pasuk says we should have yimei mishteh v'simcha, which means we should rejoice and celebrate. Mishloach manos ish l're'ehu, we should send gifts to our friends. U'matanos le'evyonim, and we should make sure that we think about the poor, as the Rambam says we are supposed to do on every Yom Tov. The Rambam writes that if somebody spends the experience of Yom Tov and all they do is sit around and enjoy the time with their own family, and they don't make time to think about lev ha'umlalim, they don't make time to think about those who may not be as privileged as they are, says the Rambam, harezeh simchas kreso. What kind of celebration is that? Do you really believe that this is what God had in mind when he said we should have a simchas Yom Tov? That we should totally neglect, we should totally ignore those in our community who need our help, and therefore in line with the regular theme that we would find on any other Yom Tov, this is the way, this is the pattern that was followed when it came to establishing Purim as well. Mishteh v'simcha is the same that we have on every other Yom Tov. We have an obligation to have a Sudas Yom Tov. So too on Purim we have an obligation to have a Seuda, Matanos Le'avyonim, as we said. And here we have this extra idea of Mishloach Manos, which is something that is a little bit different than what is normally found on every other Yom Tov celebration. But this is a very important component. All of those mitzvos, Mishloach Manos, Matanos Le'avyonim, as well as the Chiyuv Seuda, must be done during the day. And I get this question every year. There are many members of the community who go to work on Purim. They cannot take off, and they are not able to get home in time to have a Sudas Purim. And they ask every year, can we sit down at night after we have the Mikra Megillah? Can we have the Sudas Purim at night? And the answer is, you can. It's very nice. But you are not going to fulfill your obligation of Sudas Purim. So you have to make sure that you make time, even if somebody's going to be at work. You can take food along to work and make sure that you designate a time when you're going to be able to have an opportunity to enjoy a Sudas Purim. It doesn't have to be elaborate, but at least you should make some kind of time to do that. Matanos Le'avyonim, I get the question every year. It's not so easy when we have, especially those who have young children, and you're running around with them and taking care of them, it's not always that easy to find a time where you're going to have the opportunity to identify an Evyon, to identify a poor person, and then to go out of your way to find them and go give them the money. It's not such a simple task, it's not so easy, and therefore one has to make sure that they plan in advance. Planning in advance either means that you think about it before and how you're going to get it to them on Purim, or planning in advance means you give it to somebody else in advance of Purim, who you trust will give it out responsibly on Purim itself. And the Achronim say there is nothing wrong at all. You can plan that in advance, give the money now, give the money next week. This way you have one less headache on Purim to worry about. You've taken care of your obligation of Matanos Le'avyonim. Once again, I encourage you to give it to a place that you actually trust will spend the money wisely and will get it to the place where it belongs. But that is the obligation of Matanos Le'avyonim. How much must one give for Matanos Le'avyonim? That is a very good question. Every year when I ask my father, he gives a different answer, but it's somewhere around $5 to $10. Why? Because we assume you're supposed to give enough money that the ani or the evyon is able to buy something of substance, that he's able to buy something that he can use. $5 to $10 would be good enough, but I venture to say that most of us probably give a lot more than that, and we should be encouraged to give a lot more than that. The difference is, since the primary obligation of Matanos Le'avyonim is a very minimal amount of money, we would assume that anything excess of that, if let's say I gave $100 to the ani, which is a nice thing to do, I don't have to, but it's a nice thing to do, I can take the $90 off of Meiser, and the $10, I assume, has to come out of my regular bank account. Why is that? Because the Gemara says, "Kol davar shebechova eino ba ela min hachulin." When I have something that is an obligation on me, I have to use money that was not designated for a different purpose. So in this case, when I have a tzedakah, when I have a charity account, and I set aside the money for my miser, that is already set aside for something else. I cannot use that same money now to fulfill my obligation of matanos le'avyonim. Am I being clear? So you give to two aniyim on Purim the minimal amount of money that has to be money that is cleared. Anything excess of that, which is a very nice time to give, the Gemara says, kolaposhet yad nostim lo, on Purim we try to be generous people, even if generally during the year we may not be as much so. On Purim we try to be overly generous, and it adds to the flavor of the whole day, and therefore one is able to use any miser money that they have for that purpose. There is no concern at all. So that is with regard to the mitzvah of matanos le'evyonim. Then we come to the mitzvah of mishloach manos. And this is something that is often misunderstood, but please do not misunderstand me. I mentioned this in a shiur 2 years ago, and the fallout from that was my house was bombarded with matanos le'evyonim. I don't expect anybody to come visit me on Purim. You should enjoy your Purim. Don't feel any pressure. You should be happy on Purim and take care of your children or your grandchildren and go to wherever you have to be. The comment I'm going to make has nothing to do with what I expect from anybody. I have no expectation, and I would even be happier if you spent your time on Purim investing in those who may not have people visiting them. It would make me much happier. I'll be plenty happy on Purim. There are plenty of neighbors of ours who may not be so happy on Purim. Plenty of people who are shut-ins, plenty of people who, for whatever reason, do not have family, do not have a place to be, and it will make them much happier. And that is a far more valuable use of your time. Not that I don't appreciate, but I think it's important to think about those who may not be as privileged as you are and who may not have the same experience, and Purim is a great time to think about that. The Truma Sadeshan, who lived in the 1300s, he passed away in 1460. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin. In the Truma Sadeshan, which, by the way, the Rama takes many of his psakim from the Truma Sadeshan. So he's one of the most credible sources in Ashkenazic liturgy. And there, the Truma Sadeshan writes, Nira tam de mishloach manos. I didn't put it on here, but he says, the reason why we have an obligation to send mishloach manos is, kidei sheyehe lechal echad dai v'safek lekayim hasu'uda kedina. The reason for the mitzvah of mishloach manos is because we want to make sure that everybody has something to eat for the Purim Suda. That is what mishloach manos is for. So I know it's very sweet and it's very cute to send all these themed shalach manos and whatever it may be, but the primary obligation that we have of mishloach manos is that we have to make sure we give somebody something that they can actually use for their Purim Suda. There's somebody in the shul who owns a sushi store, the Shriers, and every year they send me a platter of sushi. I say to them, this is the most mehudar shalach manos in the world. We actually serve it at the Purim Suda. That is what mishloach manos is supposed to be. I'm not saying you should go out of your way and spend that kind of money. Not all of us own sushi stores. Not everybody is able to do that. But the point is that you're supposed to provide something that can be used, which means either a dessert, something that's realistic that can be used in a Purim Suda. It doesn't mean every person that you give mishloach manos to needs that, but at the bare minimum, one or two people who you're going to give should be given something that they can actually use. So then, after I said this a few years ago, the next thing I knew, everybody came to my house with, like, I don't know what it was. I could have had 10 Purim Sudas in my house. That is not what I meant at all. Don't send that to me. Send it to people who will actually use it. Send it to people who will really appreciate it. And again, I encourage you to use this time not only to think about those who you're closest with, but think more about the people who maybe you're not so close with. And this is perhaps an opportunity to make them feel very special, to help their self-confidence, and to make them feel that there really is a friendship. Mishloach manos ish l're'ehu means we're supposed to send to those that we are friendly with, or to those who we would like to feel that we should be friendly with. And that is something that is very important. And obviously that is the primary obligation of mishloach manos, is to provide something for the meal. However, in the 1500s, Reb Shlomo Alkabitz, who is better known for being the author of Lecha Dodi, Reb Shlomo Alkabitz was one of the Kabbalists who lived in Svat, and he writes in his Sefer Manos Halevi that obviously when we give the mishloach manos, it's not only because we need to provide something for the Purim Suda, but also he says, because in the days of Purim, they were Am Mefuzar U Mefurad Bein HaAmim, because we are described as a nation that was scattered all over the world, and there was a lack of achdus. Therefore, he says we should try to garner a feeling of achdus in our community on Purim, and Mishloach Manos is a great way to do that. So he says that is an additional idea. When giving out the Mishloach Manos, we should think about that as well, and we should try to do our best to be marbe shalom v'reis in the community. Purim is a great time to try to work on that, and Purim is a tremendous opportunity to mend relationships, or unfortunately to break a lot of relationships when people are offended. So this is a very important idea when we give out the Mishloach Manos. Once again, Mishloach Manos needs to be given out during the day. If you're going to be busy on Purim, make sure that you at least leave over some time to give out Mishloach Manos during the day, at least to the minimum amount of people. Matanos Le'Avyonim has to be given out during the day. Sudas Purim needs to be done during the day. And now we come to the final issue, which is Mikra Megillah. Mikra Megillah is a very important halacha. That is one of the four mitzvahs hayom. That is one of the four obligations that we have on this rabbinic holiday called Purim. And before the Mikra Megillah, we come to Tainus Esther. Tainus Esther is Yud Gimel Ba'adar, when we fast in anticipation for Purim. The problem is that there are Rishonim who write, it's not exactly clear where Tainus Esther emerged from. What is Tainus Esther all about? You'll notice that on the Hebrew calendar, there are four public rabbinic fast days. What are those? Asar B'Teves, Tzom Gedalia, Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, Tisha B'Av. All of those four were instituted by the Chachamim after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and those are in commemoration of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Tainus Esther is not on that list. So where did Tainus Esther come from? That is a very good question. The Avudram, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, is very troubled by that, and he's not exactly sure where the origins of this fast day came from. And in the end, the Ramah says, because this really seems only to be a minhag, it seems to be something that is not on the same level as all the other four public fast days, therefore the Ramah says we have a right to be more makel than we otherwise would on any other fast day. The Ramah writes very clearly in Siman Tuf Resh Pei Vav that when we come to Tainus Esther, anybody who is a mu'uberis, anybody who's pregnant, even if they're feeling fine, but if they're pregnant, automatically not obligated to fast Tainus Esther. Anybody who is nursing, even if they're feeling okay, not mechuyev to fast Tainus Esther. Then the Ramah says, anyone who's a chole she'ein bo sakana, and even if they have a mechush, even if somebody just is not feeling well, on a regular fast day, we would say, try to stick it out. Obviously, if you have a splitting headache, a migraine, whatever it may be, if you're laying in bed, then obviously you would break your fast on any other fast day as well. But over here at Tainus Esther, the Ramah says, the threshold is much lower than it otherwise would be, because we're talking about a fast which is really not on the same level as any other fast day that we have during the year. And it's hard in the first place to figure out what this is all about. Why is it that we fast? In fact, the Mishnah Berurah writes in the Shaar HaTzion that if you have a chasan and kala who got married on the week of Purim, they would not fast during Tainus Esther, even though they're completely healthy and they're fine. But the Mishnah Berurah says their obligation of simcha is more important than Tainus Esther. Tainus Esther came along much later in history, and therefore he writes that this is something they would not have an obligation to abide by, even though if they got married the week of Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, of course they would fast. If they got married the week of Asar B'Teves, they certainly would fast. When it comes to Tainus Esther, we assume that they would not. So you've been fasting all day. Then you come to Shul, and you have an obligation to read the Megillah. When do we have an obligation to read the Megillah? The Gemara says that we have two obligations of reading the Megillah. One is to read it at night. We have a second obligation to read the Megillah once again in the morning. Those are two separate chiyuvim. We have a chiyuv to read the Megillah once at night, and then the Gemara says, l'shanosa bayom, we have an obligation once again to read the Megillah during the day. When are you allowed to read the Megillah? So at night, you're allowed to read the Megillah starting from Tzeis HaKochavim. Says the Shulchan Aruch, if you have some kind of very extenuating circumstance, a doctor is going to be on call, he's not going to be able to hear the Megillah, then he writes, you're able to already read the Megillah from Plag HaMincha and on. And I get this question sometimes from nursing homes, where if you're going to make some of the participants in the minyan in the nursing home stay up until 7 o'clock at night in order to read the Megillah, it's going to throw off the whole schedule, it's not going to be healthy for them. And the question then becomes, what are we able to do? And it's a very good question. The answer is, the Shulchan Aruch says, in extenuating circumstances, you can already read it from Plag HaMincha and on, which means halfway through the afternoon on Tainus Esther, that would be sufficient, and that would be okay. We get this question also, Pesach time. You're supposed to start the Seder at night, but Erev Toch L'Matzos. And the question is, sometimes when Pesach rolls around, by the time you get to the Seder, it's very late, and the nursing homes are really unable to keep everybody up that late, that is a major question. What do we do then? So we'll deal with that maybe when we get into our Pesach Shiurim. I don't want to scare anybody now. But when we're talking about Purim, the Shulchan Aruch says, really, if all else, all other factors are equal, you're supposed to hear the Megillah Balayla, once it's nightfall outside, and then once again in the morning. We get this question every year as well. Somebody who needs to go to work and is unable to stick around for a minyan that davens at a regular time, the question becomes, how early are they able to read the Megillah in the morning? And that is a good question, because sometimes, even if you're not going to work, but it's a very busy day and you just want to get a head start, so really, the Chatchila, you're supposed to read the Megillah anytime after Hanetzachama. Anytime after sunrise, you can read the Megillah, and that would be sufficient. I also get the question every year at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 20 minutes before the Shkia. Somebody always calls on Purim afternoon and says, oh yeah, I was so busy with this morning, I was so busy with that, and I was running around doing all the things that I was supposed to do, and I was taking care of my kids, and I totally forgot to go to shul, I didn't hear the Megillah, can you send somebody over? It happens every year. Every year. And we always accommodate. We always find somebody to go to that person's house. It's a big pain in the neck. I'm just telling you in advance. It's not easy to find people. So make sure you're responsible. Make sure that you hear the Megillah before the end of Purim and before 20 minutes before the Shkia. It's important that you do so because we have an obligation. And you will ask, who is obligated to read the Megillah? After all, we have a general principle by mitzvos, which is that women, when it comes to a time-bound mitzvah saseh shehazman grama, normally the assumption is that women do not share the obligation with men. Over here we have an exception to the rule. This is one of the notable exceptions, and the reason why, says the Gemara, is the whole objective of reading the Megillah is to remind us of the great miracle that happened in the days of Mordechai and Esther. And because, says the Gemara, Af hein hayu ba'osa ha-neis, or the Yerushalmi says, Af hein hayu ba'osa ha-safek, men and women were equally involved in that threat of Haman HaRasha to destroy the Jewish people. Lahashmid, laharog, ulaabed, eskol ha-Yehudim. He wanted to destroy everyone, and therefore we assume, since men and women were both involved in that threat, therefore men and women share the obligation to commemorate the great miracle. And therefore we assume both men and women have an obligation to hear the Megillah both at night and once again during the day. So we should do our best to be in shul. If we cannot make it to shul, we should do our best to make some kind of arrangement. Which leads to the next point, which is, where should we hear the Megillah? Now, I know in our neighborhood, and in many neighborhoods, there are people who have minyanim in their home. There are a number of reasons why people make minyanim in their home. Sometimes people make a minyan in their home because if they daven in shul, there's so much noise, and they're not going to be able to hear the balkori. If that's the reason why you're davening at home, great idea. Great idea. If you're going to miss words of the Megillah, and the only way you're going to hear it is by doing it in a private minyan in somebody's home, that is a wonderful idea because you have to hear every word of the Megillah. Outside of that, there are some people who make a minyan because somebody is not well, and we don't want them to be alone. It's not nice that we should have a balkori just come and read for them on their own. So the family members all decide they're going to rally around, and they're all going to come together, and in order to make that person feel good, they will have a Mikra Megillah in the house. Also, lovely, great idea, very nice thing to do, and you're going to make that person feel very comfortable and welcome on Purim. However, there are some who do this strictly for convenience purposes, and that is completely inappropriate. The Shulchan Aruch writes that that is completely inappropriate. Why? Because we have a halacha that comes up in many different contexts, which is Berov Am Hadras Melech. And the Gemara mentions this in a number of different places. So the Gemara says that when you have an opportunity to do a mitzvah, and everybody has to do the mitzvah as a community, everybody in the community needs to be Yotzei Der Chiyuv, we assume that there is a Hidur mitzvah, Berov Am Hadras Melech, dictates that we should go to the place where there are more people. And here by Mikra Megillah, the Gemara goes out of its way to say, Mivatlin Talmud Torah Lishmoa Mikra Megillah. Which means, if I have a yeshiva, Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, the greatest value is that people should be learning Torah. And yet we have a Beis Medrash, we have a yeshiva, where there is somebody who's available to lay in the Megillah there, and we shouldn't have to make anyone go somewhere else. But says the Gemara, we make all of them stop learning, go to the local shul, because there's more people in the local shul. They have a minyan there. But since there's more people in the local shul, Mevatlin Talmud Torah Lishmoa Mikra Megillah. We assume that that is a worthy trade-off. We assume that that is worthwhile for a person to leave the yeshiva, to stop learning in order to go to the shul where there are going to be more people. And therefore the Magen Avram says here, that if you have a situation where you live in a community that there are many shuls, but one of the shuls has far more people than the other, again, this is leaving all things equal. If I can't stand that shul because it's just too much noise, or the rabbi is crazy, or whatever, you can have all kinds of ideas. But if for whatever reason we assume that all factors would be equal, then says the Shulchan Aruch, you should really go to the place where they have more people. So it would be highly inappropriate to make private minyanim in one's home unless there's a very good reason to do so. That is something that I think is often ignored, but it's mefurish in Shulchan Aruch, it's very clear, and I don't really see a way around it. Okay, we then go on to the next issue, which is very often when people fast on Tainus Esther and they come to shul at night to lay in the Megillah, they are going to be hungry, which is understandable. You've been fasting the whole day. Of course you're hungry. So the question is, am I able to eat before I read the Megillah at night? And this really opens up a halacha that appears in a number of different contexts with connection to many different mitzvah experiences throughout the year. So we look in number Aleph here in Hilchas Bedikas Chametz. And there the Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Taf Lamed Aleph, Yizayer kal adam shelo yaschil b'shum malacha v'lo yochal ad sheyivdok. We have an obligation on Erev Pesach at night to do a bedikas chametz. And one has to make sure, says the Shulchan Aruch, that you do not engage in any other activity, you do not engage in eating, until you do your mitzvah of bedikas chametz. And sometimes this can be a little bit complicated, because, for example, if you have a family unit, and somebody's out at work, and you're going to wait for that person to come home until you do the bedikas chametz as a family, maybe you're going to have to end up waiting for a little while. So shkia is at 5:30. That is when your obligation of bedikas chametz sets in, 5:30, 6 o'clock, whatever it may be. And your spouse is not going to be home until 7 o'clock or 7:30. Really, the Shulchan Aruch says you're not allowed to engage in any activity or a meal. The family should not be sitting down to dinner until you finish the mitzvah of bedikas chametz. And that is an important halacha that is mentioned there, but it's mentioned in probably five other places as well with regard to many different mitzvahs. Take for another example, we have a Mishnah in Maseches Sukkah, Daf Lamed Ches, where the Mishnah tells us with regard to the mitzvah of Dalad Minim. So on Sukkis, we have an obligation not only to sit in the Sukkah, but we have an obligation also to shake the Dalad Minim every day. And there, the Gemara discusses what happens if somebody was on a business trip, or for whatever reason, they're traveling on Sukkot, and you don't have a Chabad opportunity to shake the lulav, and you're in a community where you don't have the Dalad Minim. Now you get back home, and you're exhausted, and because you didn't have a Chabad house, you also didn't have a kosher meal, so you were totally stuck, and now you're very hungry. You come home at night, and the first thing you do is you sit down to eat a meal, because you haven't eaten all day. Says the Mishnah, Misha Baba Derech, V'lohaya biyado lito lulav. And because when I was traveling, I did not have a dalad minim. How was I supposed to have that? And now I get home, l'kishei kanes lebeso. When I come into my home, yital al shulchano. Now how does that to be translated? If you translate it very literally, it means I should stand up on the table and I should shake the dalad minim. Obviously that is not what it means. Rashi explains there what it means is, I just came home from a long trip, and I am very exhausted, and I'm also very hungry. And I also have not shaken the Dalad Minim yet. So I sit down to have a meal, and then I realize I completely forgot to shake the Dalad Minim this morning. I didn't have the opportunity to do so because I wasn't at home. Says the Gemara, you have to stop your meal in the middle. Yitol al shulchano means I stop whatever it is that I'm doing, and I go immediately to shake the Dalad Minim to take care of my obligation, and then I move on with the meal. So this is the same idea that is quoted in Shulchan Aruch there in Siman Taf Reish Nun Beis, Hilchos Dalad Minim, as is quoted in Hilchos Bedikas Chametz. And this is something that is quoted, as we said, in a number of different places. The concern that the Gemara has is, if I'm going to become too involved, if I'm going to become too distracted by the meal that I'm eating or the work that I'm doing, I'm not going to remember to do the mitzvah that is in front of me. I'm going to neglect the mitzvah of Bedikas Chametz. I'm going to forget about the mitzvah of Dalad Minim, and therefore we say this has to take priority to everything else, and therefore it should come as no surprise at all that in Siman Taf Reish Tzadi Beis, the Shulchan Aruch writes in Hilchos Mikra Megillah that you have no right to eat before you lay in the Megillah at night. Even though I'm hungry, says the Rama, I can be hungry because I fasted all day, but you have no right to eat before reading the Megillah. There is one caveat to that, and that is what we find in Siman Reish Lamed Gimel, which is in Hilchos Tefillah, and there the Shulchan Aruch says, although one is not allowed to eat before performing any of these mitzvos, before shaking the lulav, before doing bidikas chametz, before Mikra Megillah, before Neiros Chanukah, the Shulchan Aruch does write that I have the ability to do ti'ima ba'alma. Shulchan Aruch does say, if a person is very hungry, very thirsty, very distracted, whatever it may be, and you want to take a drink, or you want to just eat something quickly, not really in the context of a meal, but to have a light snack, which means some kind of fruit, or you want to have some kind of drink, that would be something that would be permissible. And that is quoted here in the Mishneh Berurah as well. If a person's been fasting all day, and now they're going to be very hungry, obviously he says you should not sit down to a meal, that is forbidden, but for a person to take a drink before they go in to hear the Megillah would not really be a problem, as long as they really feel that they need it. Now this is something that extended even further, outside of Mikra Megillah, outside of Neiros Chanukah, outside of Lulav, outside of Bedikas Chametz. Every year we have a discussion on Rosh Hashanah. As you know, in many shuls on Rosh Hashanah, they have a break in the middle of davening that people should be able to go home and eat something and have a kiddush. And this is a very questionable practice. So if you look, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes the following. Number Gimel. Kava alai nafshi. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes that it pained him. How am I allowed to leave the Sifri Torah on the Bima and go home? I'm going home to have a Kiddush. And meanwhile, it's Rosh Hashanah. I haven't yet done what Rosh Hashanah is all about. All I did was I daven Shachris. Rosh Hashanah really is Tkiyah Shofar, and I forgot about that. So I go home, I have Kiddush, and I totally neglect the mitzvah that I'm supposed to do. And says Rav Shlomo Zalman, it bothered him very much that this was done. This Techemed, who was one of the great tzaddikim who lived in Yerushalayim, he later on moved to Istanbul. Things were not good in Yerushalayim in his days, in the end of the 1800s. Passed away in 1904. So this Techemed has an amazing encyclopedia. This is before the days of computers. An amazing encyclopedia where he writes just everything about everything. And there the Techemed has a passage about this practice as well. And he says, Shamati, I've heard. Sheish mekomos etzal achenu ha-ashkenazim. I've heard that there are Ashkenazi communities. He was a Sephardi. So he says, I'm not fully aware because I don't daven by the Ashkenazim, but I've heard that on Rosh Hashanah after Shachris, you're not going to believe this, he says, Yotzim beis ha-kneses, and they go and they drink tea. Now, halavai, our kiddushes today on Rosh Hashanah would just have tea. But he says, you're not going to believe it. They have places where they stop in the middle of davening, everyone goes outside and they have a drink of tea, and then they come back. This is crazy. And he says, I can't understand where this came from. So again, this had tremendous resistance over the generations, and it's a very questionable practice whether or not one is allowed to do so. The reason why it's questionable is because, the same way the Shulchan Aruch says, you're not allowed to eat before Bedikas Chametz, you're not allowed to eat before Neiros Chanukah, you're not allowed to eat before Mikra Megillah, so too, you're not allowed to eat before Tkiyah Shofar on Rosh Hashanah. It's pretty simple. And that is why there were many who objected to this. Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who was the Gadol Hador in America before Rabbi Moshe Feinstein came onto the scene, he passed away in 1973, and he was recognized by everybody as being the leader of our generation here in America until Rabbi Moshe came along. So Rabbi Henkin was very fond of this fight. He was not happy at all that people decided to start having Kiddush on Rosh Hashanah before Tkiyah Shofar. So I once read an article. I do not get the mishpacha at home. I do not appreciate it at all. But I did see many years ago that there was an article in the Mishpacha magazine about Rav Henkin. And in that article, they had many interesting things that caught my attention. And one was that Rav Henkin, very seldom did he give smicha to any of his students. And they explain why. He just didn't feel it was appropriate. He didn't know that he can have a handle on them later on. They're all going to go off to their own positions. Who knows what they're going to do? He couldn't take responsibility. So he didn't want to give smicha. I think it says either twice or three times he actually gave smicha for some reason to these Talmidim. But he said it was conditional. And he told them, if you violate any of the three conditions, your smicha is revoked retroactively. So I was waiting to see, let's hear, what are the conditions? So the first one I forgot, you can look it up in the archives of the Mishpacha, you'll find what it is. The first one I can't remember. The second one he said was, if you are ever Mekabel Shabbos a minute early as a rabbi, your smicha is revoked. Why? Being Mekabel Shabbos early is very nice. And he said no, because the job of the rabbi is to be available for his community. And if you're going to be Mekabel Shabbos early, either in the summer or the winter, that means that your community won't be able to get in touch with you because you are already observing Shabbos. So he said, you're neglecting your obligation, and that means you have no right to be a rabbi. That is what he said. That was a fascinating condition. Condition number three is, he said, if you ever have a kiddush in your shul before Tkiyas Shofar on Rosh Hashanah, your smicha is revoked. So it shows how seriously he took this issue. So much so, they write in the article, that on his deathbed, when he was no longer lucid and hardly communicating, you could hear him saying under his breath, just make sure never to have kiddush on Rosh Hashanah before Tkiyas Shofar. So some people have things that are very much on their minds, and on their deathbed they're still going at it. So he was still going at it about not eating before Tkiyas. But we know that there are many communities who do. And the question is, what is the rationale? How do you allow it if, after all of the sources clearly state that it is something that would be inappropriate? So in the Sefer Tnuas HaMusar, which is about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, he was the father of the Musar movement. He lived in the 1800s, passed away in 1883, 84, something like that. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter writes that in his yeshiva, he felt that it would be the appropriate thing for all the students to have Kiddush on Rosh Hashanah, even though it's breaking with the clear tradition and with the clear instruction that we have for every other mitzvah that we do during the year. Here he said there's a reason to do it. Why? Because in the yeshiva, they start davening 7 o'clock in the morning, and they only finish davening on Rosh Hashanah at 3:30 in the afternoon. How can you expect that the Talmidim are going to be able to focus if they're going to be standing in shul the whole day, and they're not going to have the opportunity to eat anything? And therefore he said, for the purposes of the tefillah itself, in order to make it a meaningful experience, we have to come up with a solution. And therefore he said, he felt it was appropriate to allow the students to eat, even though it seems to be against everything that we know. The Chafetz Chaim said that he felt this was the proper practice as well. That's what they did in his yeshiva in Radin. And he said, perhaps the reason why is because maybe during any other time of the year, you're going to forget to do your mitzvah. You're going to forget about Bedikas Chametz, which is unlikely, but you're going to forget about Neres Chanukah, also unlikely. But he said, on Rosh Hashanah, when you have the Emas Hadin, when everybody's afraid and they're petrified, do you think I'm going to get caught up in the Kiddush that I'm having, that I'm going to forget about the Tkiyas Shofar? Now again, maybe in the Chafetz Chaim's yeshiva, everybody walked around on Rosh Hashanah, and it was clear that they had an Emas Hadin. I can't say that every person I've seen at a Kiddush on Rosh Hashanah has that sensitivity and that feeling. So again, you have to take this very seriously. It's an issue that needs to be thought about. There is a fascinating comment in the Stechemet where he writes, there's an age-old practice that we know a chassan and kala on the day of their wedding, very often they fast. And the question is, where does it come from? Not really clear what it's about. I think the conventional reason that everybody says is because it's the day of Mechilas Avonos, chassan and kala get a kapara, so it doesn't mean they're allowed to do all the averus in the world while they're engaged, and then it's all fine when they get married. Not what it means. What it means is that they're starting a new stage of life, and the Ribono Shel Olam gives them a chance to start afresh. And that is a Mechilas Avonos, so some say that is why they fast on the day of the wedding, in order that it should be like a Yom Kippur for them. However, one of the Rishonim writes, the Rokeach, as quoted in the Stechemed, he lived in the 1200s, he writes that perhaps the reason why is along the same lines of what we've been saying, that one is not allowed to eat before performing a mitzvah. Now tonight, I have a very important mitzvah to do, which is to get married. And therefore, because I'm getting married this evening, I should not be eating during the day, because the same way I wouldn't eat before performing any other mitzvah. Again, one of the suggestions that's given, my father once told me, when you have something that there are 10 different reasons given, it means none of them are the right one. So, I don't know, it's not clear exactly what it is, but this is certainly an age-old minhag that a chassan and kala fast, and the Stechemed writes, maybe the reason why is because it falls in line with everything else we said. Now, it should be pointed out that the Gemara does have a discussion about how this plays into tefillah in general, not only on Purim, on Rosh Hashanah, on Chanukah, on Lulav and Esrog, on Sukkot. This plays into tefillah in general throughout the year, and that is based on a Gemara Maseches Brachos and Daf Yud, where the Gemara learns from a pasuk. And this is such a problematic pasuk. The pasuk says, Lo sochlu al hadam. Try to translate those words. Lo sochlu al hadam means don't eat on the blood. What does it mean, you cannot eat on the blood? What blood are we talking about? I shouldn't sit on blood when I eat. I shouldn't eat blood when I'm eating a piece of chicken, a piece of meat. What is the Torah referring to? And this is a problem, because in general we assume, yes, shiv impanim the Torah, there are so many different interpretations to every word of Torah, but the assumption is there's always a baseline understanding of Pshuto Shel Mikra. We assume that every pasuk actually means something on face value. Anything above that is Torah Shebaal Peh, but what does this pasuk mean? And this is something that the Rishonim struggle with. The Ramban and the Rambam, all the Gedolei HaRishonim try to identify what does the pasuk mean on a pshat level, Pshuto Shel Mikra. Lo sochlu al adam, not clear at all. One of the Rishonim says, I think it's the Ramban on Chumash, he says maybe it means that there was an old pagan practice that they used to sit around the fire and they would give sacrifices to their idols, to their Avodah Zarah, and they would put all the blood in the middle and put it on the fire, and everybody would sit around eating meat as they were watching this blood boil on the fire. And therefore he says, lo sochlu al adam means that we should all make sure not to do like the Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Don't sit around this fire, don't watch as the blood is boiling. That is going to be a practice of the Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Maybe that's what it means. Again, it's not relevant to us today. We don't even understand what that means. But some say that's what it means. The Gemara says what this means is the following. Lo sochlu kodem shetispalalu al dimchem. Which means, every morning when you wake up, you have no right to eat or to be engaged in breakfast or other activities before you are mispalel on your own blood, before you ask God to give you another day of life. And therefore, the Gemara assumes that we have a prohibition to eat before davening. Again, this has nothing at all to do with any of the Yamim Tovim we discussed. This has to do with every day of the year that we don't have a right to eat before we go and daven. And this, the Gemara says, is not only based on the pasuk of Lo sochlu al adam, but it's also based on a pasuk that says Va'osi hishlachta acharei ga'avecha. That you basically went and pampered yourself. Your gaiva, you had to take care of yourself. You threw me out after you finished taking care of yourself. Then an afterthought was, oh, let me remember, I should really be having some kind of conversation with God. And the Gemara says that is inappropriate, and therefore we assume you're not allowed to do that, which leads to a whole slew of questions. So, the Achronim then say, I'm sorry, this is not the Achronim. One of the Rishonim says, in the Hagos Maimini, Rab Meir HaKohen lived in the 13th century. The Hagos Maimini writes, well, if all I'm doing is having a drink of water, I wake up in the morning and my throat is groggy and I just want to wake up a little bit. So he says, you want to take a cup of water. That's not gaiva, that's not arrogance, that's not pampering myself. And therefore he says that would not be any part of this prohibition. There's nothing wrong at all. That would make sense. So then that sort of snowballed into something much bigger. So it started off with, you're allowed to have water because that is not considered pampering or catering to myself. Then we went from there to the 1600s when they said, okay, what about water with some kind of flavor? We would call it coffee, right? So coffee or tea. So in the 1600s they said, all right, that's the same as water. It's not really doing anything. It's not taking care of myself. That's just having water, but putting a little bit of flavor into it. That was in the 1600s. But they said, obviously, you're not allowed to put sugar in. No way. Then it snowballed a little bit more, and the Chidah in the 1800s writes, well, there's no such thing as coffee without sugar. Nobody would ever drink that. And really, it's just some flavored water, so it's not really anything. It's not taking care of myself. It's just waking me up. It's giving me an opportunity to focus. So then they said, you're allowed to have not just the hot water with flavor, but you're allowed to add in some sugar, but obviously no milk. No way. Then it got to, okay, you can't have a coffee without milk. I don't know, I've never drank a coffee in my life, so I don't know. But I assume most people don't drink coffee without sugar or milk or sweetener or something. So they say, obviously, that's all part of the coffee experience, and we assume that that would be something that is permissible. Is everybody surprised that I look like I'm sleeping? What's the problem? So the answer is it's doable. You can be a functioning human being without ever having drank a cup of coffee. It's not so bad. Try it once in your life. So, although that is true, that you're allowed to have a coffee before davening, keep in mind that I do not think the Achronim meant that also can now mean the way we interpret it, that we should go to Starbucks and order the very specific and particulars with the, you know, with the ice cream dumped inside also and the whipped cream on the top. I don't know. I think that's a little bit extreme. Again, to have a coffee in the morning is okay. But to do that in a way that gets back to the original issue, which is Osi Hishlachta Acharei Ga'avecha, is a problem, which again gets to the issue of people who take showers before davening. I think most people take a shower in the morning because it makes you feel like a mensch. It's not because I'm catering, I'm pampering myself. It's because this is what I do. Or some people go to the gym in the morning. I don't think it's because they are pampering themselves. I think it's just because it's part of my routine. It makes me feel good. It gets my day off to a good start. And I will serve God better if I'm all ready to go in the morning. I will probably daven better if I've already exercised and I've taken my shower and I've done what... Again, this is all part of that same idea that is discussed about the water. It depends why it's being done. It depends what exactly the person is doing, and that really is something we should consider. How did we get here? Good question. But the this is something that is discussed with regard, again, with regard to Purim. It's discussed with regard to Purim. Again, one should try not to eat before the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah is fulfilled, because we don't want you to neglect the mitzvah that is at hand. We then come to a question. If we have an obligation to read the Megillah both at night as well as during the day, what happens with the bracha of Shehecheyanu? I don't know if we have any Svardim in the room. Any Svardim here? But this is a dispute between the Mechaber and the Ramah. So Svardim follow one practice, the Ashkenazim follow the Ramah, which is the other practice. And this is, all comes from Tosos in Megillah on Daf Dalet, where Tosos says, how can you say Shehecheyanu twice? Doesn't really make sense. The first time you read the Megillah is at night, but then you read it again during the day. It's the same thing. So why would you say Shehecheyanu twice? So when you go to shul, do you say Shehecheyanu twice or not? Yes. Every Ashkenazi shul says Shehecheyanu twice, and that doesn't really make sense. Tosafot says you're doing the same thing. Maybe the first time you lay in the Megillah, it makes sense. I haven't done this in a year. But by the time the morning mitzvah rolls around, I've already done this last night. Why would I say Shehecheyanu? Tosafot is not sure exactly what to do. Tosafot then writes, he thinks that we should say Shehecheyanu a second time in the morning. Why? Because all the mitzvahs hayom apply during the day. And the day is really the primary focus. The nighttime is one thing, but the day is really the primary obligation. The Mikra Megillah burned during the day is more important than the one at night, and therefore he says we should say Shehecheyanu a second time, even though we said it already at night. Which is an amazing opportunity. You get to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu twice. Shehecheyanu v'kiyamanu v'higiyanu lazman hazeh. How lucky can we be? Take a moment to think about it. Every Yom Tov, take a moment to think about how lucky you are. Look around you and see how many people since the last Purim do not have the privilege of being in the position that you're in. How many people since last year do not have the opportunities that you have? Shehecheyanu is an important time of year to really give ourselves a reminder of how grateful we need to be and how lucky we are to have all that we do have. So Ashkenazim follow the practice of the Ramah, which is in line with the practice of the Balei HaTosas, that we say Shehecheyanu both at night and once again during the day. However, the Mishneh Berurah says, because this really is a questionable practice, because Tosas himself is not exactly sure how to justify saying Shehecheyanu twice on the same mitzvah, therefore the Mishneh Berurah says in the name of the Shalah, that when we have the Shehecheyanu being said during the day, we should have in mind that it goes not only on the Mikra Megillah, but it goes also on the Matanos Le'Evyonim, the Mishloach Manos, and the Sudas Purim that we're going to eat. You probably have heard the Gabbai and Shul announce that, but that is what the announcement is all about. Because we're not sure why we justify Shehecheyanu during the day, therefore we have in mind when we say Shehecheyanu that this goes not only on the Megillah that we're about to read, but it goes also on all of the mitzvahs Hayom that we are about to fulfill throughout the course of the day. It is important, as the Gemara says, it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch as well, Siman Taf Reish Tzadi, that you have to read the Megillah mitoch haksav. What does it mean, mitoch haksav? It means not from a printed chumash, it means the Megillah must be read from a klaf. So, I would venture to say, most people in a shul probably do not come to shul with their own klaf. But we are listening, Shomea Ka'one, we listen to the one who is reading on behalf of all of us, and that is fine. What happens when there's so much noise in shul and I miss a word? Well, if I miss a word and I don't make it up, I have to hear the Megillah again. Shulchan Aruch says, if I miss one word of the Megillah, I've invalidated my mitzvah, I have to hear the whole thing again from a klaf. So it doesn't help to go home and read the whole thing again from a chumash. I have to hear everything again from a klaf. However, don't be scared off. If you daven in a shul and you see that you miss a word because there's too much noise, somebody next to you sneezed, whatever it may be, you miss a word along the way, so you are able to catch up by reading in your chumash. You are able to catch up by reading from a printed chumash. Now you'll ask yourself, how does that help? If you're supposed to be reading from a klaf, how does it help that I read some of the words from my chumash? Why does that count at all? And the answer is because you'll look in the very end of Megillas Esther, where it's referred, the Megillas Esther itself is referred to by two different names. It's called a sefer, and it's also called an igeris. What is the difference between a letter and a book? I've never published a book, but I've known many people who do publish books. Before you publish a book, You're careful how it's written. You send it to the editors. Everything has to be just so and perfect. If not, the book won't sell. It's not a book. When I write a letter, every so often, you misspell something, you leave a word out here or there, you cross something out, you scribble. It's not as official as a book would be. Says the Gemara, there are two components to the makeup of the Megillah. On the one hand, it's supposed to be a sefer, it's supposed to be a professional book, it's real. On the other hand, it has some aspect, some element of an igeres, which means, says the Gemara, if I have a few letters missing here or there, if I have a few words missing here or there, and I make it up from the ksav, and I make it up from the chumash, that will be sufficient. So again, if you're in shul, and you've missed a couple of words, or let's say this happens all the time, people come into shul a minute late, and they miss the whole first 3-4 psukim, and they're frustrated and they're upset, so they just sit down. The problem is, it's not going to help if you sit down, because you missed the beginning. It's not something that you're able to make up later. So what you do is, you sit down, catch up, read inside of your chumash, catch up the first few psukim, and when you get up to where the Baal Kori is up to, just start listening. And that would be sufficient. That would be okay. One final halacha that is worthy of mention is what the Shulchan Aruch says there as well in Siman Tav Reish Tzadi Beis, that before you read the Megillah, we recite a bracha asher kedushanu b'mitzvos v'tzivanu al mikra Megillah, right? We read the Megillah. Sometimes we make a bracha l'shmoa mikra Megillah. It's a question when you have a tzibra like this, a tzibra like that, a good question. But anyway, we make a bracha before we read the Megillah. Shulchan Aruch says one should be careful not to be mafsik, not to talk, from the time that the bracha is made until after the Megillah is completed. And what it means after the Megillah is completed is after the bracha, after the Megillah is completed. So we say a bracha, a very short paragraph on Leil Purim, Asher Heini, right, which is a bracha after the Megillah, so we should make sure that we do not have any hafsaka. We should make sure not to talk from the start of the bracha on the Megillah until all the way at the end when we're finished with the final bracha on Mikra Megillah after it is all completed. And that is the obligation that we all have. That is the opportunity that we all have. Once again, the four primary mitzvahs of Purim are Mishloach Manos, Matanos Le'Avyonim, Mikra Megillah, and Sudas Purim. All of those have very specific guidelines. Anyone who has any further questions should feel welcome to ask. But this is the basic background of the halachas for Purim. Once again, next week we will continue with more hashkafa on Megillah Esther. But until then, I